Welcome to Character Explorations, a podcast production of the Wendt Center for Character Education at the University of Dubuque. I'm Annalee Ward, and our guest today is Dr. Donovan Tan, Professor of English. He is the author of the article, Beyond Inevitability, Telling Another Story About Climate, an article that appears in the Journal of Character and Inevitability. And this essay is available online at www.dbq.edu/WENDT. That's www.dbq.edu/WENT. Welcome, Donovan.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we're happy that you're here today to talk us through your essay a bit. On this very, no pun intended, hot topic, why did you want to take a look at climate change when we were exploring inevitability?
I think that's a great question. I think one of the things that I was excited about working with this group was an opportunity to think a little bit just beyond my own disciplinary boundaries and to explore that a little bit further. And climate is something that's been on my mind for a long time. I read through one of the books I reflect on extensively through here is a book by David Wallace Wells called The Uninhabitable Earth. And it's a very small book, but it's one that I had told myself before that before we have kids, I wanted to read that book and to think a little bit about what that future means. And in a lot of ways, it's a deeply sobering book and took me a few months just to sit through and process. And one of the things that I took from that experience and those reflections was, in a lot of ways, how we think about climate is, in a lot of ways, how we think about the future in general and what it means to face and to be truthful about the challenges that are ahead of us, but also to think about the ways in which we can face them and the ways that our choices and decisions are still important and still matter. And so for me, it came to connecting some of those personal reflections with what I thought was a time where it was perhaps okay for someone outside of the sciences to step in. In a lot of ways, there's a lot of science that is now much more settled than it was even a few years ago. And now, in a lot of ways, it's how we respond to it, how we think about the changes that are ahead of us and the changes that we need to know. You mentioned the heat. You know, we're in the middle of a pretty substantial heat wave, right? And there's news articles this week going around showing that, you know, estimates suggest this is about 35 times more likely than in a pre-climate change world. And so this is something that is very much of the moment, but also comes out of those personal reflections for me as well.
Thank you. Well, one of the early sections of your article is titled Navigating Climate Confusion. And I appreciate that because there are so many news stories, so many experts, and so much divisiveness over is it real? If it is, what needs to be done? What are the best practices? Where do you recommend we begin to talk about this angst in our public discourse?
In public discourse? Well, I think it's my first part of the answer is I think it starts with personal relationships, right? I think it starts with us thinking about examples and thinking about ways that we can sort of demonstrate engagement with this. So, you know, from my personal background, I come out of an Anabaptist background as well as a Quaker background. And so there's a lot of emphasis, for example, in the Quakers on the sort of earth care witness and this idea that that witness is something that is practiced and it is embodied and that that is part of your work and your worship as a community. And so I think for me as a person of faith, I think the idea of a community centered around principles like simplicity, around principles like earth care is something that I've seen modeled there, right? And so I think there's a lot of work to be done there. On the other hand, when it comes to the broader discourse, I think it presents, you know, some significant challenges, right? I've worked myself with political campaigns, and what that experience in a lot of ways forces you to decide a little bit between kind of which groups you're speaking to and to sort of understand your audience in a lot of ways, right? One of the things that really struck me from this was not the fact that there was a number of people that were stridently opposed to this idea of human sourced climate change, but that there was a really substantial number that said they didn't know, right? And I think in some ways, the people that are uncertain, the people that are confused, in some ways are, for me, the people that I think are most interesting in that debate, right? The people that are not just preaching to the choir, because it's easy to preach to the choir, right? And not just, you know, getting to an argument with someone that doesn't want necessarily to listen to you, because that can feel gratifying and, you know, you can log onto the internet and do that every day. But to talk to someone and sort of model that, that sort of personal investment, personal connection to that, I think can help to address when people have confusion about this. So, you know, for example, we had, when we put solar panels on our home, right, we had at least 2-3 different neighbors knock on our door at random times. You know, we have a small child at home, so we tried to push down a little annoyance about that. But to ask, oh, you know, what's, you know, what did you do here? Like, were you happy with it? What's your electric bill like? You know, and that idea of, you know, I could go and knock doors in my community and say, oh, solar, you know, solar is really important. But that simply seeing it and getting used to that, I think, as a value is something that people could see and recognize. And once you see that, I think momentum is really significant, right? One of the statistics that I cite later in the paper is this idea that a large-scale social movement needs 3.5% of the population really to gather that momentum and to be transformative, right? In some ways, I think that is where I begin, right? Is to say, what does it mean to foster and build connections where you are first? Because, you know, I'm one person. I can't necessarily hold myself responsible for a broader discourse. I can contribute as far as my reach is, but I also can't keep myself up at night because someone else is doing the opposite thing. I don't have control of that. I can control the kind of witness and practice that I model in my own relationships in my community.
I appreciate that you just used the word model, mm-hmm. because it speaks so to the anxiety and the apathy, the two kinds of responses. Mm-hmm. Just listening to you speak, that emphasis on relationship and modeling really is a wonderful answer to those kinds of anxieties and or choices of not mm-hmm. participating. Yeah. Well, uncertainty that really we all experience because we don't have all the answers, it raises questions of inevitability. And how do you suggest countering that sense of we're all doomed or it doesn't matter what we do, it's all inevitable?
So the unusual choice that I make in this article is to choose the idea of imagination. And I think for me, one of the things that I've been thinking about as we've been thinking towards this conversation is really the writing process. And I, as a writing teacher, am someone where I am asking students, asking my colleagues to attend to process as much as to product. And I think in a lot of cases, we focus on product in decision making. And I think, yes, that matters. Yes, it matters to do things. And I think we often see the work of discernment, the work of wisdom, the work of creativity as something that is, because it doesn't have a product you can feel and touch, as something that is less valuable or less meaningful. And so for me, I want to suggest that the work we do in considering an alternative, the work we do in trying something new, even if it isn't necessarily successful, the work we do in researching something, trying to make a change and finding, you know, that isn't the best idea, let's improve and move forward. That improvement, that process of learning and growing and developing is meaningful. I think that we exhibit character as much in that learning and that discernment as we do in the product itself, right? And that's probably not a surprise. You know, I'm an academic. I love the life of the mind. I still think we have to do things. But I also think that doing things at the expense of careful knowing and careful discerning, or to suggest that those things aren't important, I think can make it really hard. Because I think one of the things that I wanted to highlight is that this sense of confusion isn't accidental, right? The sense of confusion isn't simply something that we inherit, right? The idea that climate is confusing, right, is yet another story that we receive. And in fact, right, there's a lot of work that goes into that idea to suggest, oh, this is a personal choice. Things are confusing. I would suggest in a lot of cases to unsort that, to dig through that is necessary work. And it's work that that discipline and thinking is something that our to exhibit good character requires as well. So that idea of imagination is a word I wanted to use in part because it was surprising as a way to say, to think, to imagine, to be creative is something that we require in order to act with good character, instead of simply to carry a hammer around and find nails, right? We have to decide whether we should be carrying a hammer around at all, right? We should decide, right? Is this the kind of decision that we should be making?
I really appreciate that. The Wendt Character Center here, one of the virtues we talk a lot about is integrity. Mm-hmm. And we reference Stephen Carter's definition, which he has a three-step definition of integrity. And the first step is discerning between right and wrong. And adding that discernment and that imagination opens up possibilities and brings hope, but also challenges us in a fast-paced world to slow down. One of the tools of slowing down that not only you, but others on this little research team referenced often was storytelling. And as you tell these stories, do you think that there are actions you want to direct the stories to? Are there actions that you want to recommend for us?
I think the answer is yes, but I also want to suggest that, again, action isn't the only thing, right? And I think that storytelling in itself is something that connects us, right? Something that we do. And I think I want to include that in action as well.
Agreed.
And I think that idea is something we don't necessarily see, right? We often have so much of an emphasis, and to some degree, rightly so, on impact, right? And I think those are significant. And we talk a little bit, you know, later in the article about some of the specific things, specific recommendations. But I would say one of the most important actions in some ways is to cultivate an imagination, to cultivate a willingness to see other options instead of the ones presented in front of you, particularly as I think about college-age students. This is a time when a lot of students are seeking to discover for themselves what their values are and to figure out how they can live them out in their careers. And I have seen a lot of students, they'll come in and they'll say, okay, making money is the most important thing. And a year later, they're struggling, they're having, you know, real difficulties, not necessarily because they're not doing well in their major, but because it isn't something that embodies necessarily what they want to be, that connects with who they are as a person. And I think self-discovery and reflection is something that is still an action that matters. And I would say to connect self-discovery, to connect that sense of reflectiveness with action, I think is important, right? Whether, you know, in terms of practical things, you know, I would say, you know, there's always opportunity to, I think, to think a little bit more modest, to think a little bit more small, right? I was thinking, you know, integrity is one of the, they talk about sort of summing up Quaker values with the acronym SPICE, right? And SPICE is simplicity, peace, integrity, community, and equality, right? And simplicity at the beginning, in some ways, I think is this idea that, you know, what we can imagine for ourselves in the future, a lot of students, you know, I think to some degree inherited by our culture, see success as, you know, luxury, the big house, the big, all of these sorts of things. And one of the things that I appreciated in our conversations within the issue as a whole with the other other researchers is to see the things that really matter to us underneath, right, aren't things necessarily the money buys, things like relationship, things like community, things like connectedness. And so in some ways, I think those things are really significant. And, you know, the benefit of, you know, a more generally modest lifestyle is that you have that opportunity to sort of downsize a lot of our impacts, right? Everything we do sort of has those impacts. What you do every day has that grander impact, right? There's things where you can, you know, you can give something up, okay, one time, and you can feel good about that. But to do something like live in a slightly smaller house, right? Or to decide, you know, I don't need to replace this thing every few years, and I'm just going to consume a little bit less. That's something that as a lifestyle, I think we can, you know, take care of things as we do, right? It's like the, you know, when you go hiking, they have the, you know, what you carry in, you carry out, right? And the idea of thinking about those impacts and sort of organizing to some degree our lifestyle around those is significant. But on the other side is you have to extend yourself grace, right? That's the thing, you know, we've spent a fair bit of time agonizing, should we use disposable diapers? Should we use, you know, cloth-based diapers, et cetera, et cetera? And good luck digging into it. We probably should have used cloth in the end now that our energy was in fact solar. But we also knew that we wouldn't have enough energy to literally function if we didn't end up using disposable, right? And that's a decision, you know, for better or worse, we had to live with so that we could function. And so I think we have to seek that balance every day between choosing wisely, but also being able to care for ourselves and extend the grace necessary so we can make a good decision tomorrow instead of revisiting only the bad decisions we made in the past. Because the future will look at us and say, boy, those were some poor decisions, right? And I think we have to accept that fact, right? The things that we think, oh, this is going to improve everything, this is going to be a great green change. I think we have to face the fact now that that's not all going to be, we're not going to have 100% hit rate, right? But we still have to extend ourselves grace, and we still have to try.
We try. And as we have moments, days of success, they begin to add up and impact our communities. Any other words of advice for communal action? Because I love approaching the community from where we stand as individuals. I mean, that's sort of the American mindset. But are there things that we should push our communities towards that you'd like to see us take action?
I think one idea, and it's not necessarily a solution for everywhere, is to think a little bit about values of resiliency. And I think that is something that I think about when it comes to issues of sustainability, right? We're in a situation now where, you know, we have this substantial heat wave. We've had, you know, I was just telling my partner the other day that we keep having, you know, a kind of thunderstorm that we're like, oh, this is really unusual. I bet that's the last time that will happen. Probably not, right? And so to think about ways in which at a local level, we can think of these not as being, you know, sort of, you know, do-gooders from out of state in some ways, right? The things that we can connect with are, you know, when we come to things like water management, right? I think, you know, there are states that have done a lot more in terms of water management. You know, I came here from Kansas, there are states that have done less. But, you know, in a place like Dubuque, right, we have a river right here, right? When it comes to things like flooding and those other things, right? When we talk about making good decisions when it comes to water use and water management, for example, that's something where it affects ordinary people, right? And I think that's a story we can connect to people to say, hey, this is something that isn't, you know, something we do purely out of the goodness of our hearts, and hopefully it's good, but this is something that also helps make our communities more resilient when we face future challenges. I think it's something we've seen, for example, in adoption of solar and renewable energy in Texas following some of those recent power grid issues. And I think it's created interest in those things, as well as interest in making change at a political level as well. And so I think thinking about ways in which our community and others will be affected, because our communities and others will be affected, and to say, here are ways that we can make our communities more resilient when we face challenges. And we don't have to wait long in most cases to identify those, because they're on our doorstep. And so they will be here. The challenge is to act with enough foresight for future challenges as well.
Donovan, thank you so much for this. Our guest today has been Dr. Donovan Tan, Professor of English. And I am wondering if you have any last words you'd like to leave us with.
Yeah, I think what I would like to suggest is, number one, that when I talk about imagination, I want to suggest that it is not as easy as we make it sound. I think imagination is something that we think about as kid stuff, right? As something that is just something for kids to imagine and make up stories. But I think in a lot of cases, especially when we think about things like media and things, right, the power of story is so significant, and it helps organize our lives. We think about in psychology things like cognitive behavioral therapy, which Dale talks about in his article as well, that the stories we tell, even at a personal level, shape kind of that horizon we see in front of us. And so one of the ideas that I would want to leave us with, actually, I returned to the Jemison story this week and was rereading it. And I think one of the things I find about it is that it is so pointedly convicting in a lot of ways, right? And which is kind of an old school way to talk about this. But you sort of come through, and there's points when everything has this kind of utopian quality. And we talk about how people are equal and people are valued. And then, you know, they talk about, oh, well, here's some harder stuff, right? And you can sort of feel a personal sense to say, oh, okay, now this feels realistic, right? And the author says, okay, why do we need bad things to feel realistic? Why is this something that's going to, you know, why do we need pessimism to make it feel like it's something that can happen in our world? And the author, Jemison, goes out of her way to say, no, this is possible, right? If we want it, it's possible, if we're willing to fight for it. And so this idea, I would say, is these things, the kinds of choices we believe are possible, shape the decisions we make, right? And to say, don't just accept the decisions that you see in front of you. Sometimes there's another choice. And to think about that and to imagine that is harder work than it looks.
Thank you, Dr. Tan. And I am Annalee Ward for Character Explorations from the Wendt Center for Character Education at the University of Dubuque.